We will begin with Nehemiah 1, verse 1. The words of Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah. In the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in the citadel of Susa, Hananiah, one of my brothers came from Judah and some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that had survived the exile, and also about Jerusalem. They said to me, "Those who survived the exile are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates have been burned with fire." When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Then I said, "Lord, the God of heaven, the great and awesome God, who keeps his covenant of love with those who love him and kept his commands, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer your servant is praying before you day and night for your servants, the people of Israel. I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my ancestral family, have committed against you. We have acted very wickedly towards you. We have not obeyed the commands, decrees, and laws you gave your servant Moses. Remember the instructions you gave your servant Moses, saying, 'If you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. But if you return to me and obey my commands, then even if your exiled people are at the farthest horizon, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. They are your servants and your people, whom you redeemed by your great strength and your mighty hand. Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. Give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of this man." I was cupbearer to the king. On the 28th of August 2005, the world watched Southern America. It was, of course, the time of Hurricane Katrina. Hurricane Katrina, which had started as a tropical storm, hit the south coast of America as a Category 4 storm, one of the highest there is. And we watched as much of New Orleans was destroyed during terrible flooding. 80% of the city was flooded. It was known as a vibrant city, a city where people went to enjoy themselves, to have fun, a city that was different, that had different cultural ways of doing things. But in a couple of days, it was almost wiped out. Thousands of people died. And thousands more had to leave their homes and go and live in other places. 5 years on from that disaster, there are still thousands of people who haven't been able to return to their homes. Much of New Orleans is restored, but there are areas where houses are blocked up, where supermarkets are closed forever, where people's livelihoods have disappeared. There are thousands of displaced people living in areas that weren't their home, trying to make the best, with little hope of returning to the place where they once lived. And you know, when we reach the book of Nehemiah in the Bible, we get a similar kind of feeling to that of New Orleans. Because you see, the book of Nehemiah is about a people who have found themselves in equivalent circumstances, if you like. It's a time when there are people who have been forced to leave their homes, when they've been forced to settle in different places that weren't the places they chose to live, when they've become a displaced people. Now, of course, the history of the people in Nehemiah and New Orleans is very, very different. There's no connection there. For instance, we don't have a natural disaster here in the Bible, and we're not in America, although I guess if you did a film, it might end up in America. And the period of time between destruction and this book is not 5 years. It's much, much longer. Instead, you see, we're looking at the book of Nehemiah following the people of Judah. A people, of course, who are known as God's people. We've talked about that before. A people who used to live in the northern part of God's kingdom. This was their land. And a people who worship God in the temple of Jerusalem. The holy place, the best place they could worship God, their home. And the disaster that has overcome them is a disaster caused by their enemies, the Babylonians, who, due mainly to Judah's unfaithfulness to God, it has to be said, had taken over the land, destroying all that they knew, knocking over their temple, ripping down the walls, and overcoming the people, taking them off to a distant land, to Babylon, and ordering them to live there, where the people of Judah have sat lamenting for years what used to be and dreaming of perhaps what could be again. And this, if you like, is where we encounter Nehemiah, albeit 100 years or more after the destruction of Jerusalem and the exile of its people. Nehemiah, of course, is one of the people of Judah. He's a follower of God. He's one of the displaced people. And he finds himself in Babylon, of course, serving the king as a cupbearer, a very important position. He has to taste the wine of the king in case it's poisoned, so the king doesn't die. But he's also a listening ear when the king wants to talk to someone. That's his role. And it's in this role that he one day hears of news from Jerusalem, that distant land where his people used to live. Now, what we need to know before we reach this point of Nehemiah is this, that since the destruction took place all those years ago, there have been a group of people who have gone back to Jerusalem and started to rebuild the city. The story is described in the book of Ezra, which is the book immediately before Nehemiah. The two books used to go together. And what they've done on their return to Jerusalem is they've rebuilt the temple of Jerusalem, the place where the Jewish people worship God. In the process, as you'll find if you read the book of Ezra, there's been much opposition, much hardship, much trouble. But eventually, after many toil and tearful days, they've built the temple of God in Jerusalem. The symbol that points to the fact that God's people are alive and well and back, if you like. And so when Nehemiah hears this news from Judah, from Jerusalem, from his homeland, he might be expecting it to be good news. He knows the people have gone back. He knows they've rebuilt the temple. This might be news of great joy. Things are happening again. But the news that Nehemiah receives at the beginning of this book is not good news. It's not good news at all. In fact, it's described in terms such as trouble and disgrace. Because you see, although the temple of God is built, we're told that the walls of Jerusalem are broken down, that its gates have been burned with fire, meaning that although the temple's there, there's no protection for it. The land is not secure. It could be overtaken at any moment by the enemies. This is not good news. But although it's not good news, there is still no reason to believe that Nehemiah himself should do anything about it. I mean, that's not why he's asking of news in the first place. He has a role in Babylon. He's lived there for years. He's got quite a good position. And up till this point, we've had no indication that he desires to go back and help restore his homeland. He's not a prophet. He's not a priest. He's not a leader of the people of God at this point. He's just an ordinary man, serving God in the land he happens to be in. And yet, when Nehemiah hears this bad news about his homeland, it seems to change him completely. It's as if he suddenly wakes up and he realizes who he is. And immediately after hearing the news, he sits down and he weeps, and he mourns, and he fasts, and he prays. And he calls on God to take his life again, to use it to restore this kingdom which he once used to dream of. Or if you like, Nehemiah, so moved by this news of the plight of his fellow people, so moved by God, that the first thing he does on hearing news is recommit himself to God and to the people of which he is a part. And you know, although this is in the Bible and it's probably quite expected, people do this all the time, I find it quite challenging. Because although we don't live in the time of Nehemiah, and although, to be fair, we don't really know what it's like to be away from the land our ancestors always dreamed of living in, we haven't got that history, although our circumstances are very different, we're still the people of God. We still link into this history. We're still God's people living today. And so when we look around and we see what's going on in the world, when we hear reports of how life is for those around us, when we encounter hardship and trouble, our response should surely be along the lines of Nehemiah, an ordinary man, so moved by what was going on that he wept, he mourned, he fasted, he prayed for the destruction and the broken lives that he heard about. And yet often we're not like that, are we? I mean, there are occasions when we see something and we're moved to tears. But often we just accept life. This is how it is. Or we're too tired to fashion a response. And we simply live each day, just like everyone else, going through, surviving, hoping that life will change, thinking that one day God will come and make it all right. But surely, as the people of God today, we have a role to play in this making it all right. And just like Nehemiah, we should be prompted to wake up and realize who we are, the people of God, united to do something. Surely we should use every opportunity to recommit ourselves to God and also to recommit ourselves to each other. After all, we're part of the people of God in Cottenham. We're not isolated people who just happen to sit next to each other every week. Now, normally, you know, I might continue talking, do a nice sermon. Well, might be nice, a sermon. And at the end, you might go, that was good. We'll, you know, now go and have our dinner. But I'm not going to do that. We're going to stop. And we're going to spend time thinking about our commitment to God, our commitment to each other. There might be some things that we need to do. We might have to engage in the service and commit something of ourselves. Or we can just sit and listen and watch other people as they do things. But we're going to work together this morning. You're not going to listen to me much longer. We'll work together and be led to respond to God. And maybe you could just use this time, think, right, well, I've got half hour, and I'm going to see what God wants of me this morning. I'm going to open my mind, open my heart to him, and see what he wants to say to me, to us. I'm going to follow the prayer of Nehemiah, who firstly worshipped God, because God is a faithful God. And then confessed to God his sins, said sorry for the things that he'd done, maybe the life he'd led that wasn't overly committed, we don't know. And then he'd lifted the problems of his people and himself to God and committed himself again. And that's what we're going to do during this next half hour or so. So first of all, I'm going to start by reading some worship to God. Now, you should have a piece of paper. Does everyone have a piece of paper? There'd be one out the front if you haven't. And as I'm reading from the book of Isaiah, Song of Praise to God, I want you to just think of one word you would use to describe God, one thing you'd like to praise him for, one aspect of his character which you love, something which comes to you. Just write down the one word as I read and as you listen to what is said. The book of Isaiah talks about God and it says, "Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, or with the breadth of his hand marked out the heavens? Who has held the dust of the earth in a basket, or weighed the mountains on the scales and the hills in a balance? Who can fathom the spirit of the Lord, or instruct the Lord as his counselor? Whom did the Lord consult to enlighten him, and who taught him the right way? Who was it that taught him knowledge or showed him the path of understanding? Surely the nations are like a drop in a bucket. They are regarded as dust on the scales. He weighs the islands as though they were fine dust. Before him all the nations are as nothing. They are regarded by him as worthless and less than nothing. With whom then will we compare God? To what image will we liken him? As for an idol, a metal worker casts it, and a goldsmith overlays it with gold and fashions silver. People too poor to present such an offering select wood that will not rot. They look for a skilled worker to set up an idol that will not topple. Do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood since the earth was founded? He sits enthroned above the circle of the earth, and its people are like grasshoppers. He stretches out the heavens like a canopy and spreads them out like a tent to live in. He brings princes to naught and reduces the rulers of this world to nothing. No sooner are they planted, no sooner are they sown, no sooner do they take root in the ground than he blows on them and they wither, and a whirlwind sweeps them away like chaff. To whom will you compare me? Or who is my equal, says the Holy One? Lift up your eyes and look to the heavens, who created all these. He who brought out the starry hosts one by one and called them each by name. Because of his great power, might, and strength, not one of them is missing. Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired or weary, and his understanding no one can fathom. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint." Let's stand and worship God in song as we remember how great he is. Immortal, invisible, God only wise. A beggar lived near the king's palace. One day he saw a proclamation posted outside the palace gate. The king was giving a great dinner. Anyone dressed in royal garments was invited to party. The beggar went on his way. He looked at the rags he was wearing and sighed. Surely only kings and their families wore royal robes, he thought. Slowly an idea crept into his mind. The audacity of it made him tremble. Would he dare? He made his way back to the palace. He approached the guard at the gate. "Please, sire, I would love to speak to the king." "Wait here," the guard replied. In a few minutes he was back. "His majesty will see you," he said, and let the beggar in. "You wish to see me?" asked the king. "Yes, your majesty. I want so much to attend the banquet, but I have no royal robes to wear. Please, sir, if I may be so bold, may I have one of your old garments, so that I too may come to the banquet?" The beggar shook so hard that he could not even see the faint smile that was on the king's face. You've been wise in coming to me, the king said. He called to his son, the young prince. Take this man to your room and array him in some of your clothes. The prince did as he was told, and soon the beggar was standing before a mirror clothed in garments that he had never dared hope for. You are now eligible to attend the king's banquet tomorrow night, said the prince. But even more important, you will never need any other clothes. These garments will last forever. The beggar dropped to his knees. Oh, thank you, he cried. But as he started to leave, he looked back at his pile of dirty rags on the floor. He hesitated. What if the prince was wrong? What if he would need his old clothes again? Quickly, he gathered up the garments. The banquet was far greater than he had ever imagined. But he could not enjoy himself as he should. He had made a small bundle of his old rags and it kept falling off his lap. The food was passed quickly and the beggar missed some of the great delicacies because he was holding on to his rags. Time proved that the prince was right. The clothes lasted forever. Still, the poor beggar grew fonder and fonder of his old rags. As time passed, people seemed to forget the royal robes he was wearing. They saw only the little bundle of filthy rags that he clung to wherever he went. They even spoke of him as the old man with the rags. One day as he lay dying, the king visited him. The beggar saw the sad look on the king's face when he looked at the small bundle of rags by the bed. Suddenly, the beggar remembered the prince's words, and he realized that his bundle of rags had cost him a lifetime of true loyalty. He wept bitterly at his folly, and the king wept with him. Sometimes the things we do in our lives that aren't right before God become comfortable to us. We don't always want to let go of the way that we are, because it's the way we are, even if we know that God has offered us a better way to live. Trouble is, the longer we cling on, the more comfortable our lives become the way they are. But if we let go, God has so much more for us.